My name's Paul Bestall. This is Mysteries and Monsters on the Paranormal UK Radio Network. Welcome to Mysteries and Monsters. This week, we're delighted to welcome Lyle Blackburn back to the show to talk about his last few months and the explosion in two notable cases he has been involved in, Momo the Missouri Monster and the legend of Boggy Creek, or the Folk Monster as it's otherwise known. We cover both cases, his continuing work with Small Town Monsters, and what Lyle is currently working on, a new book covering the mysteries and legends of swamps around North America, as well as one of the new Small Town Monsters films for 2020, The Mothman Legacy. Once again, thank you for all the support for the show from around the world. To see where the show is now reaching is amazing, so don't forget to drop us a nice review on your podcast app to help the show grow and reach more people, or share it on social media. Thank you again for your support. You can also find us on Facebook, Instagram and Twitter, as well as subscribing to the Mysteries and Monsters channel on YouTube. Don't forget, next week is the 50th episode, so drop us a line at mysteriesandmonsters@gmail.com to let us know what your favourite show out the first 50 has been, and we'll give you a shout out next week. Right, time for this week's episode, and welcome back to Lyle Blackburn. This week, I am delighted to welcome back Lyle Blackburn to Mysteries and Monsters. Lyle is a renowned author, investigator, narrator, and also performs vocals and guitar for his band Gulltown. With more TV and podcast appearances than you can shake a chupacabra at, Lyle is one of the most well-known cryptozoologists in the field today. Lyle, delighted to welcome you back. How are we?
I'm good. Thanks for having me.
Oh, pleasure. Well, what a year last year was. Obviously, started it off with the release of your latest book, Momo, the Missouri Monster, which was bookended the end of the year with obviously the wonderful Small Town Monsters film. How did it feel for you last year? Because it seemed like you kind of elevated yourself even higher than your reputation already preceded you.
Well, you know, that's what we strive for, right? Yeah, it was a good year. I mean, in one of those rare instances when the various things that I do kind of converge together by the release of the book on the Missouri Monster on that subject, and then followed up by a film by the Small Town Monsters film company, which not only highlighted the events of the Missouri Monster case, but sort of took it in a interesting and unique direction with the way they did that documentary film. So, you know, we called it the Year of Momo, and it was something that I've always loved that story since I was a kid. So it was cool to kind of have a look at that in the modern times and to release those exciting products.
Yeah, I think it was interesting because I think it's one of those stories, as we touched on when you appeared way back on episode two, that I think unless you were really into cryptozoology and strange hominid cases around the States, I don't think Momo was really that well known outside of certain circles, Lyle. So do you think that case has kind of really been pushed forward, what with your book and the film as well?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's one of those that kind of existed in the legends and lore of Bigfoot, and while the creature is not exactly described as the ubiquitous Bigfoot, it was one of those where if you would see like a cryptozoology map of the United States, there on Missouri, you would always have Momo represented, you know, and much the way the Falk monster or the Boggy Creek monster is represented for Arkansas. And, you know, I've covered some of these cases in the past where it's a case that had a big surge maybe in the 1970s or something. And, you know, a lot of newspaper coverage, but no one had ever really written a comprehensive book on it. So Momo's one of those that sort of existed in cryptozoology circles. Bigfooters knew of it, that sort of thing. But it's never had a look, especially with the documentary films, kind of going back and interviewing witnesses or people who recollect all those events that occurred in the 1970s and look at them in the modern light.
Mm. I mean, I was really impressed with the film. I mean, I usually am with the small town monsters, but I think because it was the team had kind of attacked it in a different way to some of the normal ones and kind of had a lot of fun with it. And obviously some of the guys were playing roles in the film, but there was some shots that went out because I spoke to Seth just before it came out last year. And I was really, it really made me laugh, Lyle, in a good way, because there was a real, and I don't mean this disrespectfully, there was this wonderful cheesiness about it, and the way that you were kind of bookending the clips and the witness reports with you pretending to be this host of this wonderful show. I really enjoyed it, and some of the little sort of in jokes he was doing where you were sort of gazing off into the sunset and things like that. I just thought it was a fabulously funny film with a wonderful story at the heart of it as well.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that approach was different than the other sort of straightforward documentaries Seth has done in the past. And, you know, he kind of threw out the idea to me about embedding that sort of fictional idea that I was hosting a cable access television show, and we were looking at a alleged film that had been made in the 70s about Momo. And so I'm looking, I'm thinking, you know, this is definitely unique and something different. I said, this is either going to be the best thing we've ever done or the worst.
Yeah, I think it's one of those things. It's either going to go one or two ways, isn't it?
So, but I was down because, you know, you have to kind of become inventive, because you can't, even though we're talking about a new creature or a new case, you've got to find different ways to offer up the information and to have fun with it. So, you know, I saw exactly what he was wanting to do. And, you know, the fact that it's kind of cheesy and all that just plays right into what, you know, the concept of that, and especially being 1970s and stuff or an old movie, it just kind of had a little bit of the Legend of Boggy Creek type feel. And and so, you know, I was happy the way it came off, and especially for what kind of budgets and things we work with, it looks quite good. And I was proud of what we did, and people responded well. You know, I think most people liked it overall, and now people know more about Momo.
Yeah, I think it's been interesting as well, because it seemed to be one of those that crossed over into kind of more mainstream horror, that I think a lot of people who perhaps weren't aware of Momo or Small Town Monsters or yourself, it seemed to really pick up some traction on perhaps sites that it wouldn't normally have been noticed by, I think, Lyle.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, I mean, because it wasn't just sort of this straight documentary, and it had some elements of a horror movie and all that. Yeah, it was, you know, covered by blogs that normally just cover horror movies and things like that. So I think that's great, because to me, these subjects of cryptids and things like that, you know, dwell in the realms of horror movies, because these are essentially quote unquote monsters that people are reporting in real life. So to me, there's not a very thick line between what is maybe something scary or inspired by a story that's made into a horror film and something that's a documentary where people are saying, look, I was scared to death. I saw this, you know, big hairy creature coming at me, or something humanoid flying through the air. So it's great that we got that outside coverage, because I think it exposes Small Town Monsters films to a wider audience that may not otherwise look into it.
Yeah, and like you say, I think it was interesting that Seth and the team and yourself decided to go down a certain route, because like you say, I think sometimes it's difficult to try and do something different when, you know, the previous work that you've collaborated on and the rest of their films are outstanding documentaries in, you know, in their own light, and Seth's clearly and the rest of the team have clearly tried to mix it up a bit, but this was a real departure. So I think that was for me probably not that it was getting you know, that they needed to do it. So it was refreshing to see that they were prepared to take a risk, because with the greatest respect, it's very easy to just keep on doing the same thing when you've had such good responses to previous work.
Oh, certainly so. Yeah, I mean, it's a little bit of a risk to do something outside your own box that you've created, especially when it's, you know, the reviews and the viewership of these small town monster films is well up and above any sort of thing of an independent nature. So yeah, it was certainly a risk, and like you say, we didn't have to do it that way, but I think we approach each of the subject matter as it needs to be. And with Momo, unlike some of the others, we didn't quite have as many witnesses as we normally do, because the case is old and a lot of the formative witnesses had passed away, or in one case, just couldn't talk on camera. So that kind of gave us, Seth kind of re-envisioned a little bit of that, just to perpetuate the story in a visual way, whereas we didn't have the witnesses to just, you know, tell you in their own words. So that was one of the reasons, obviously, but, you know, it works well, and that way you can try something new and gauge the reaction of the viewership. You know, you can always go back to the regular formula, but it's fun to mix it up.
Yeah, very much so. Like I say, I was really taken away with it. I thought it was fantastically done, and it really made me laugh, because it was just the way it was done and the way it was designed, and your performance in the film as this central host. I just thought it worked fantastically well. So you must be very proud of it.
Yeah, I'm definitely proud, and you know, I kind of go and film these things or offer up some research or suggestions on the script, but otherwise I don't see it till it's pretty much in its final format, you know, like, hey, here it is, we're going to release it in a few days, you know, check it out. So, you know, I just kind of hope for the best, but I looked at it and thought, wow, that's pretty good for a guy who, you know, I don't have any training in acting or on camera presentation, you know, and normally I've narrated these, my voice has some amount of training from being a musician and so forth, but you know, just just hoping for the best that I look okay on camera. And you know, I film my parts in roughly 24 hours, you know, memorizing that whole entire script, so when I see the end product, I'm like, hey, you know, that's really good.
Outstanding. So let's just have a quick recap of the case then, Lyle. So for anybody who's unaware of it, what is Momo?
So Momo is the name given to a creature who was first noted in the early 1970s in the state of Missouri. And Momo, the name itself, comes from the abbreviation of the state Missouri, which is M-O, and then monster, sort of shortening that to M-O, so it comes out Momo, which kind of almost implies some cuddly, fuzzy creature, but when in fact what witnesses were describing was very much a very frightening and startling, upright, Bigfoot-like creature. And it all started on July 11th, 1972, in which some kids in the small town of Louisiana, Missouri, which is on the far eastern border of the state of Missouri, right along the Mississippi River. They lived in this small rural town, and their house backed up to this wooded area called Marzoff Hill. And two young boys were playing out back when they looked up and saw this hulking, hairy creature standing there looking at them. And they said it was – maybe 6 foot tall. It was covered in dark hair. It was standing upright on two legs. The hair covered its face. Its head was large. They described it as like a pumpkin-sized head. And it was holding in its arms what appeared to be a dead dog. And so obviously when you look up and see that in your backyard in the afternoon, it's frightening. And you,
yes.
You know, these boys ran for the house screaming and ran inside. And their older sister, Doris, who was 15 at the time, looked out the window and also saw this thing. It lingered there in the on the edge of the woods for a few minutes and then darted back up Marzoff Hill. So they called their mother, who promptly called their father, Edgar Harrison, and sent him home to check on the kids. And, you know, they obviously told him the story, and based on their conviction and their emotional reaction, he certainly believed that they had seen something, you know, weird. And so that set off sort of a quick succession of newspaper articles and people in the town, you know, having sightings themselves of this creature, which they theorized to live up on Marzoff Hill because it was wooded and, you know, thick and shadowy. And so this had a lot of newspaper coverage right there in July of 1972, to the point where it was picked up by the Associated Press and syndicated to other newspapers, and quickly created this whole summer of monster fury in which people were, you know, coming to hunt the creature. The police were involved, you know, people running all over Marzoff Hill with guns. It was just one of these really crazy things that you just can't even make up. I mean, it's like, you know, like a horror film come to life. And not only were there sightings of this creature, which was obviously like a Bigfoot type thing, but there was sightings of strange lights in the sky and even strange crafts and people hearing disembodied voices in the woods. So it actually encompassed other paranormal activity, if you will, in the case. So it's one that has sort of been established in the golden age of cryptozoology, which was around the 1970s. A high period of high strangeness, and ever since then people have kind of been interested in it, and so it's one that, you know, gained a lot of newspaper coverage, and then the subsequent sightings that happened after those Harrison kids saw it just sort of reinforced the fact that maybe something was living up there in the woods of Missouri.
Is it one of those that, obviously, since the book's come out and the film's been released, Lyle, has anybody else kind of come forward? Because I know sometimes there is occasions where, you know, certain cases come back into fashion, or people bring them back into the light, as it were. So has anybody kind of come forward with additional information since last year, or has it just kind of carried on ticking along with the original report?
Well, in any of these cases, it seems like no sooner have I released a book, but somebody sees it and say, oh, you know, I saw something at that time. So, yeah, just like in every time, there's been people who, you know, have seen the announcement of the book or the movie, or they've read the book and then will tell me about something that occurred, you know, that something that they experienced, whether it was back in the time or something more recent. So there's been a few of those, and I was on a radio show with a rather infamous DJ here in the States out of Chicago, and he had seen something out there and wanted me on the television show, and I was like, wow, this is, you know, I didn't even know about his sighting, you know. And so yeah, there's just a number of those that have kind of reinforced the idea that something weird was going on, and perhaps is still going on, because people do report Bigfoot type sightings in Missouri even today.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's one of the aspects of the case that people, I think, either overlooked or weren't aware of, Lyle, is the fact that there were these additional phenomena that were going on. It wasn't just a monster sighting, like you're saying. I know the film touches on strange lights in the sky and the disembodied voices in the woods when people, like you say, these posses turned up monster hunting, which is one of those remarkable things that seems to occur in a few American cases, because obviously the same thing happened when the Mothman flap, literally, excuse the pun on words, began, that, you know, everybody started turning up at the TNT area, you know, locked and loaded and ready to hunt it down.
Yeah, it's just, it's crazy how that stuff happened, especially back then. I mean, in the Momo case, the chief of police was getting all these reports, and of course, at first, he's like, oh, yeah, okay, whatever, you know, maybe people are drinking too much or they saw a bear. But the more that came in and from credible citizens, the more he thought, well, something's going on here, you know. And they did organize a posse of 20 men and went up there and combed Marzoff Hill a couple of times, you know, in a serious effort to find out what could be up there. And not to mention the out of town, you know, would be monster hunters that came in as a result of the newspaper coverage. And it's just running around on the hill. In the movie, what was cool is we got a couple of cameos by Cliff Berrickman and Bobo, who were on the show Finding Bigfoot. And so they're in the movie playing roles of these police guys up on the hill, which, you know, just adds a little fun to the whole thing. But it really did happen. And it's there's so many of those, like you say, with Mothman and, you know, Boggy Creek Monster and Lizard Man. There was so many of these cases that people plunged into the woods with guns that in some of my books, I'm almost like saying, okay, well, and here's the ubiquitous monster hunt, you know, in which they always search, but really never find anything. But it's amazing how much of that went on back then.
Yeah, it just seems like, yeah, it was as though people were just basically just twiddling their thumbs waiting for the next monster to turn up. We're like, right, everybody in the car, let's go.
Absolutely. I mean, it was just, again, you can't make this stuff up. And there was a situation in the Momo flap in which about 3 or 4 days after the Harrison kids saw that in the backyard, they were having a prayer meeting there at their home. They were religious and had this like Wednesday night prayer meeting every week. And there was, you know, a dozen people standing outside the home after the meeting, and they saw these lights streak across the sky. And then they hear this loud sort of metallic clanging noise, which turned into this big rumbling growl. And it was so scary that Miss Harrison ran out of the house and wanted her husband Edgar to get him out of there. She's like, I've had it. You know, first there's a monster and now there's these noises and lights. And they jump in the car, and by the time they start heading down the street, there was this mob of people heading up towards Marzoff Hill, sort of like the villagers with pitchforks. I mean, and she just leaned out the window and said something to the effect of, it's coming, or they're coming, or something, and all these people just scattered. It's so much out of a movie, but it really happened, you know.
I think the only disappointment I can think, and I think Seth kind of touches on this in the film, and you certainly do in the book, is that unlike some of the places that have essentially embraced their monstrous past and their weird and wonderful incidents over history, it seems as if this town has basically buried it in the 70s, and until yourself and the film came out, not a lot of people really either even knew about this case, even if they lived in the town.
Yeah, well, it was a shame to find that, because, you know, I go up there to do some research, and when I first started working on the book, and, you know, I'm hoping to see, you know, statues of the monster and stuff, but there wasn't anything. And I went into the library, which you would assume, you know, would be celebrating local culture, even if it was something like this, but they, you know, and I announced who I was and tried to give them my credentials, and they didn't seem very impressed. And I told them I'm going to write a book on Momo. And they just, you could tell it was sort of like, why, you know, and, you know, and my, you know, just proceeded to get them to show me the newspaper articles and stuff on file. But But I think they're really missing the boat here because the town, it's not like the town, it's a great little town and it's a little river town and it certainly has many aspects of Americana to celebrate. But hey, this tale is the most famous thing out of there, I think. And they should actually absolutely kind of consider, having a Momo festival or a Momo days and, having some fun with it because it really does bring people into the town. I mean, and look at the Mothman Festival, 12,000 people showing up now in its, yearly event. So, hey, why not?
Absolutely, and I think, with the greatest respect, these towns in the modern era are probably struggling to survive or raise their heads to try and even encourage anybody to come and visit them anyway, Lyle. So, surely it's of a benefit for everybody in the town that they perhaps try to embrace it a little bit more.
Yeah, I think so. And I mean, I think it's just the nature of, they kind of think it's silly or, and a lot of people think it was a hoax. And like any of these cases, you always have several people claim that it was them that masterminded it and what have you. But, to me, that doesn't matter. It's the story and the fact that it was, gained so much press and people remember it today. It makes it part of, the local culture. Whether you take it serious or not. And so I don't think they, want to play up the monster. And I'm sure they certainly don't understand that other places have festivals and draw people. So, they maybe someday or maybe next time I go to visit or something, I can talk to the right people that may want to organize something like that.
Yeah, absolutely. Because I mean, like we touched on there in regards to Mothman, I think outside of, if you love the weird and you live outside of America, Point Pleasant, anybody who's into weird phenomena, everybody knows Point Pleasant in West Virginia, whether they've been to the States or not. Everybody recognizes that name now. And I'm a little bit sad when I see, like you say, these towns who aren't embracing, because like you say, regardless whether it's true or not, it's modern folklore. And it's something very different to probably towns in the area. It gives them the edge.
Yeah, sure. I mean, it puts them on the maps so much so that, yeah, I mean, someone from the UK who may not know anything about West Virginia, if they're interested in the paranormal, suddenly they're looking at a map, figuring out where Point Pleasant is. And hey, that's something that, is an attraction. And perhaps they may visit the States and be within driving distance and say, hey, why not go check out this area? So you never know what kind of tourist attraction it may have. So you might as well embrace it. And, I mean, for me, it's like my geography knowledge has increased, a hundredfold just because when I investigate these cases, I start looking at some town I've never heard of and I'm looking at the map and I'm trying to figure out where it is, who lives there, what kind of what kind of environment or terrain it is. So I learn a lot of geography from cryptozoology.
I think that's one of the secret benefits of being into cryptozoology, Lyle, is that all of a sudden you said, especially for somebody like me who doesn't have a vast experience of mid-America, it's wonderful to be taken on these trips around certain states and certain towns. Because without that, I'd probably have no idea outside of the coasts, other than major cities or my knowledge of NFL teams where they play. Outside of the coast, I think it's wonderful because it. Some of the places in these areas are just so wonderfully beautiful, and the landscape around them is phenomenal.
Absolutely. I mean, and in the converse, I mean, studying things like this, such as, the Beast of Exmoor,
Yes.
from the UK, it's like I may have never heard of the Fields of Exmoor, had I not, started reading up on sightings of the mysterious cat-like creature. So, now my knowledge of a faraway place, and if I'm ever remotely near Devon or Somerset or what have you, I'm going to go there, because to me, that's it's great, cool, you know, a regional spot that I want to visit. And the reason I know of it is because there was supposedly a mystery monster, you know.
Absolutely. Well, if Ghoultown ever get a gig in Cornwall, we'll know why.
Exactly.
I suppose that's one of the benefits of being in a band as well sometimes, Lyle, as we touched on last time when we were talking about your love of Boggy Creek, because I know that was something that you enjoyed watching on the tour bus over the years. And I mean, that's obviously something else in the last 12 months that has seen a massive resurgence. Obviously, I know you've done two books on Boggy Creek, but obviously with Pamela getting the ownership of her father's film again, that's back in the news, because obviously she's, you know, basically pulled down all the pirates that had it on YouTube and things like that, and essentially had it remastered and re-released. And you've been working on that as well, I believe.
Yeah, I've been working with Pam on that. And, you know, Pam being the daughter of Charles Pierce, who directed the original Legend of Boggy Creek movie from 1972. This whole idea and project to find it and restore it and everything has been something that, you know, she has the power to kind of forefront. But certainly as the Boggy Creek guy, if you will, I've been involved and helped her. And certainly by getting what that film really deserves and getting a new version out there, and we've been doing screenings here in the States, and it's the Blu-ray release is imminent now. That's been a big surge for the Boggy Creek thing. And, you know, just kind of it just never quite goes away. It's just one thing after another will keep that story alive, which certainly helps interest in my books and the subject. So that's another thing that kind of came in the mid of the year of Momo. Also, it was kind of yet another year of Boggy Creek.
Absolutely. And it's, as we said when we spoke last year, you know, Boggy Creek's a film I've been aware of for so long. As I said, incredibly, it was shown on national telly here in the UK at 6 o'clock at night with no warning of its content. And when you're an 8-year-old who loves monsters, you sit down and you think, oh, brilliant. It absolutely terrified me. I still have nightmares about that chap in the toilet who has an unfortunate incident, shall we say. He's probably sat in the right place for something like that to come. But and you know, and that's the best part of 40 years ago, Lyle. So it's a film that's always been close to my heart here in the UK. So it just shows you the power of these films, that if it drops on at the right time in the right place, people will take that with you for the rest of their lives.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, because that film was so much out there and even had international distribution, that, you know, it had the potential to affect all of us who love that kind of subject matter if it hit us at the right time. And, you know, it surely did, you know, build up so many fans. And even those that saw it originally have loved it so much that they showed it, you know, to their, you know, children, who would then show it to their children. And in fact, we just did a screening of that, of the movie, the restored version, in Dallas this weekend. And there was a family there who had three generations of fans. The father had actually seen the movie in that theater, I think, when it came out back in the circulation of 1973, he saw it. And then his daughter was, you know, loved it too. And then her son was there. So I'm looking at three generations of people who had been affected and loved that film. I was like, wow, this is just amazing. You know, just the effect it had on people like that.
Yeah. I mean, it is interesting how it's, and it seems to obviously kept this cult following going. And I think it's been really pleasing to see that there was clearly a lot of people waiting for this film to be rescued, as it were.
Oh, absolutely. I got that question constantly. Just, you know, people would ask me, of course, you know, facts about the Falk monster. And the next question was, when is somebody going to, you know, fix up the movie and re-release it properly? And so I really thought it'd never happen until Pam kind of got the ball rolling and saw the potential and was able to legally get a hold of the rights, which was a long process unto itself. I mean, she's been working behind the scenes for years now, kind of an uphill battle to get a hold of that film, get the rights, get one that could be transferred and cleaned up digitally, and even getting the money, because she self-funded all this all along. And it, trust me, it is not cheap to get a film remastered by the Eastman Kodak, professionals. So, that's just, something that this film has been severely lacking. And now finally, people can see it in its proper glory. And in fact, I think the restored version in some ways exceeds probably what people saw in the movies originally. I mean, because now it's been, digitally brightened and touched and fixed up, that they didn't have the technology to do that back then. So it's like, it's just night and day. But the film and the cinematography is really comes forward, and you see what a great film it is by being able to view this great version.
Absolutely. And I think some of these films really do deserve this kind of remastering, because it really does. I think it makes it almost like a different film, Lyle, because it just looks so clean and so crisp. I mean, I've only seen the trailer that's been remastered, because obviously it's not been released over here yet, the new version. But it looks incredible compared, I remember the original version, and obviously seen a fuzzier version over the years on video and stuff. So to see how it looks now, it's beautiful. It looks amazing.
Yeah, it is. And there's scenes in there that I saw that I couldn't see before. There was one particular section. It's a little dark. I mean, it's a monster movie, so you have to, some things are shadowy, but when they've been dubbed several times from VHS and then released on a bootleg DVD, those scenes become pretty much totally black. And there was one scene that I was like, I've never really seen this before, because you couldn't see it on the dubs. And so this, while it was still in the movie all along, it was almost like a lost piece of footage, because now I could see what was going on, and you can see the quick view of the back of the creature and the hair up close. It was like, wow, this is cool. And that's the way it should have been all along.
Yeah, absolutely. So how's things in Fouke then? How have they, because I know there's always been it was one of those, I think, that at the time they kind of put it to bed, but I think it's once again over the years that people have been coming, and I know when you first arrived, have they kind of really fallen back in love with their monster over the years? Because I think when you first went there, they didn't really celebrate this creature.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen a slow, steady increase in, embracing this over time. And I think right now it's more than ever. The folks in the town, really understand the significance of it. And, while just like any place, some of them have an interest in it and some of them don't. Overall, when I go up there, everybody wants to talk about it and mentions, and if anybody's heard of a sighting, they'll tell me. And the Monster Mart, which is basically a convenience store there, that has, souvenirs and stuff. We've been able to slowly build up this small museum in one of the rooms, in its back room, where people can see some of the historical items related to the legend of Boggy Creek. So, we've slowly built that up. And because so many people come there, and even more so, there's people coming there just to see things. So, you want to give them something. So I think the town has really embraced it, and everybody's, happy that we have a Fouke Monster Festival now there in the town, which last year, it was sold out. I mean, we couldn't even put all the people in the venue we had. So people come in there and want to go on tours and see all this stuff. And, it's great, tax revenue for the city while you're actually giving people something to see, because people really want to come there and experience something. And it's fun to show them all the sights and tell them the history and things like that. So, it's wonderful to see all those things.
Absolutely. And it's good to see as well, because, you know, as we mentioned on Momo, obviously this is a town that has basically re-engaged with itself over this and seen the benefit that... would you say they were quite surprised to find out just how many people knew about the creature outside of the city limits? Or was it that kind of thing, well, everybody went nuts in the early 70s and then it all kind of disappeared for 30 years?
I think anybody in Falk who has traveled around has always been surprised at the level of notoriety, because I hear, they'll tell me this all the time, you know, somebody's like, yeah, you know, I went, you know, somewhere for work or what have you, you know, I was in, you know, New York, or, you know, they could be in a restaurant or something, and they say when somehow people overhear that they're from Falk, Arkansas, it never fails that somebody will come over there and say, well, I'm sorry to interrupt, but is that, you know, have you ever seen the creature, you know, that, and they'll just be like, I just couldn't believe it. You know, I'm way across the states and suddenly somebody's wanting to talk. And so, yeah, they're constantly surprised at how well known this is. And that's another reason why I think over time, you know, everybody there just says, hey, we're proud of our legend. We, you know, whether we can prove it or not, it's still significant cultural, you know, roadside attraction at the least that they can be proud of.
Mm. So has anybody continued to have any kind of experiences there, Lyle, or is it, do you think it's one of those quite similar in regards to, you know, once again, comparing it to Momo, that it seemed to happen at a certain period of time and then not much has happened? Or have there, because I'm sure that there's been sporadic reports ever since, but probably not as many at the same time that the original stories are based on.
Right. Yeah, there's been a steady stream of them that have come out of there, you know, over the years. And I still get, you know, quite a few reports each year that I think are, you know, credible enough to, you know, to log in on the sighting reports. Yeah, it certainly doesn't have the pile on fury that it did in the 70s, where it was just in the news every other day. And that kept everybody kind of wanting to come forward telling their story. But even though it's, you know, every time I go to Falk, I almost learn of a new sighting or some new bit of information that I didn't know before. And so the most recent sighting was just a few months ago, in which a woman saw something fitting the description of the Falk monster cross a roadway. So, you know, I'm constantly investigating these, and whenever I can, you know, I go up there and kind of look into them. And that Boggy Creek being my sort of first and foremost thing that I research, you know, and close enough to where I can go up there and look into the sightings when they happen. So, yeah, it's a constant thing. And if people want to look at the sighting log, I have a Falk Monster website, which is falkmonster.net, F-O-U-K-E monster.net. And there's a sighting log on there, and I'm constantly sort of passing that around. When I see people on social media saying, are there still sightings? I'll just post that link and they go and look and say, oh my gosh, you know, I didn't realize that it had been seen that many times just since the 70s, you know?
Yeah, I think that's, you know, as with anything, Lyle, and that's, you know, it's fabulous to see that people are still coming forwards. And I think, once again, it's one of those things where, no, probably to your chagrin, once the book came out, somebody probably, oh, well, I saw it about a week after all this happened, no doubt.
oh, yeah, it was, yeah, one of the best sightings ever happened, you know, like, you know, right on the heels of the book published. And, you know, luckily in the case of Boggy Creek, see, I feel like it's okay, because, you know, I did write the follow-up, which was called Beyond Boggy Creek in Search of the Southern Sasquatch. And in that I sort of explored the whole deep south of the U.S. In the history of sightings of similar creatures. And then I sort of added in some of those other, you know, sightings that I couldn't include in the first book, The Beast of Boggy Creek. And I plan to write a third one So I can eventually put in all these other ones that have occurred. So luckily I have enough material in a place that I can put them. So it doesn't freak me out too much when all these great sightings come in after the fact.
It's the cryptid that will not die, Lyle, I think. No doubt. We know exactly what's going to happen when the book comes out, don't we?
Oh yeah, that's even more. So, I could be writing. This could be my Harry Potter series or something. I just continually put out Boggy Creek books, and hey, if so be it. I love it.
Fantastic. Well, it's a wonderful, I mean, it's like I say, it's one of those stories that stayed with me my entire life. So it's one of the key reasons for why I love this wonderful, weird subject of cryptozoology is down to Boggy Creek. So we owe Charles Pierce a great deal of thanks, I think, for that. So, I mean, you've got once again already, I know we're only just into 2020, but you've already got a couple of things coming up that are planned in. So delighted to see that you're going to be working again with Small Town Monsters on the final part of their trilogy for the Mothman Legacy.
Right. Yeah, I'll be narrating that one, which goes hand in hand with our other, the Mothman of Point Pleasant, which I originally narrated, and keeping in that format. So I'm excited about that. Mothman is the other cryptid that never dies, or it always flies, let's say that. And so, people are excited about another installment, which we can sort of look at the bigger picture of sightings, similar sightings, and what's happened in recent years with the Mothman case. So, yeah, that's an exciting one to be a part of.
Absolutely. Well, I was lucky enough we had Tobias Weiland on, obviously with his book regarding the Lake Michigan Mothman, because obviously at the moment it seems to be back in fashion, but incredibly it seems to be more well spotted and more certainly more reports about it in its modern version than there was back in the 60s.
Yeah, I think so. And, perhaps that's because we have an easier way to share information now. Even if the paper doesn't decide to write about it, somebody can, submit it to one of these investigators, and it can appear on blogs and things very quickly. So this dissemination of information allows us to gather up sightings very quickly when there's a flap such as this, where all of a sudden, a Mothman-like creature appears in a particular area.
Yeah, absolutely. And I know obviously Seth touched on the modern ones in Terror from the Skies, because obviously that was dealing with winged cryptids, and whilst most people were perhaps suspecting it would just be about sort of giant eagles and pterodactyl sightings to sort of just pigeon some of those reports together. But then the final part of the film is obviously focusing on what on earth is going on in Chicago, and it's quite interesting that it really does seem to have just picked up a whole new sort of wave of information and reports about the whole thing.
Yeah, certainly. And that was one of the kind of hidden bonuses about Terror in the Skies, and it was that the film, that documentary was surprisingly popular. And I think it's because we touched on, not just the Thunderbirds and the pterosaurs, but also the Chicago Mothman, and the sort of tying these incidents together of people seeing strange things in the sky, obviously. And the whole Mothman type sightings in Chicago are pretty freaky, because you're in a city. Now you're in a city environment. It's almost like this sort of Batman type creature, flying above rooftops and so forth. And here we are in modern times, and we're still getting flaps of strangeness in certain places. And the fact that it's in a big city is almost even more intriguing, because you would think that would be relegated to shadowy rural areas, but this is the big city, so it's been a fascinating case.
Yeah, I think that's what makes it stand out at the moment, because like you say, city environments do not lend themselves to mysterious creatures, you're more likely to come across a haunting or poltergeist in urban environments. Certainly not winged creatures being spotted in the skies.
Right. And so, you know, that perhaps makes it stand out and somewhat unique. So it's gotten a lot of attention because of that.
So in regards to you yourself, for a new book, I believe you've got a very different subject, something you've not touched on before, which is going into the wonderfully spooky and dangerous world of mysterious and haunted swamps.
Right. Yeah. I decided, you know, to kind of do something that's more geographically based than what I've done previously, is where it's, you know, revolved around a certain monster case. And this sort of has come out of the fact that a lot of the cases I've investigated have something to do with bayous or swamps. And I'm certainly living down here in Texas, I'm in the deep South where there are a lot of swamps and spooky environments. And it seems like I started looking, and it just seemed like all the major swamps I could find always had a history of really strange and creepy stuff. And I love that whole, you know, the feel of the swamp, the environment and the creepiness of it. And so this also gave me the chance to examine other paranormal type occurrences in addition to the cryptids. I mean, obviously, you know, people see, you know, things like Bigfoot near swamps, but they're also seeing other phenomenon, ghosts, and there's stories of buried treasure and witches and all this other creepy stuff. So I thought, you know, this is a whole theme right here. So the book I've been working on kind of revolves around swamp, notorious swamps, and whatever may lie within.
I mean, they do tend to lend themselves more to mysterious stories and dangerous warnings, I think, because there's just something about them, especially if the mist just hanging above the ground a little bit. They just seem to be eerie places that attract weirdness.
Oh, yeah. You know, and that's sort of the question that's proposed here is, you know, is it, you know, are the things happening because the environment is conducive to that? Or are these things happening there because, you know, that is a place where something, you know, could hide in relative obscurity, you know? So it's like, are our imaginations running wild because it's a swamp, because it's, you know, this primordial creepy place, or quite naturally, those are the most uninhabited places remaining around the U.S. So, you know, aside from large mountain tracks, and, you know, that's a cool question to kind of weave in and out through there as we examine the tales. And I've been to quite a few of these swamps. So in the book, as I've done in the past, it's not just me sort of regurgitating a bunch of facts and stuff. I can actually describe the, you know, the environment, the feeling I got when I was at these places. So I can bring the reader along, much as I've done in these other cases, to those environments as we sort of analyze all the high strangeness that has, you know, bubbled out of these boggy environments.
Yeah. I mean, it is quite interesting. And obviously, as you refer to, there's quite a lot of states have certain things. Has anything turned up that you were unaware of, or perhaps didn't know as much about as perhaps you realized?
You know, what struck me in this research was how one small area could have so much phenomenon. You know, there could be a cryptid sighting, a spook light, ghosts, you know, tales of a witch, and even crazy stuff like theories or facts, literal facts about crashed planes that had crashed in these swamps and had disappeared. Nobody could find them because they were just sucked in by the mire. And I'm like, wow, that's nuts. You know, I could be canoeing in some swamp and literally going right over the remains of some aircraft that nobody had has ever found, things like that. And you realize how much could be hidden in there and just how much phenomenon is concentrated in one certain area once you sort of, you know, start back and examine old newspaper reports all the way up to what people are reporting today, and you put that all, pack it all into one chapter, you go, oh my gosh, you know, this is, I just had no idea there was so much stuff that could go on in one particular area.
Yeah. So has it kind of taken you out of the southern states? Have you gone all over the US, or have you basically stayed sort of left to right across the south of the country?
The majority of them just that are the most notorious or that had the most phenomenon seem to be concentrated in the southeast portions of the states. But I do cover other ones, for example, Hockomock Swamp, which is associated with the Bridgewater Triangle. And that's all the way up in Massachusetts, which is the New England part of the U.S. So it's quite far away. And that's one that I have not been to. Just obviously hard to get, yes. You know, to get to them all. But and there's others. I mean, there's ones from Michigan and other places, some of which I've been to and some of which I haven't. But the majority of the most notable ones, especially in the South, I've at least visited, if not actually canoed and camped or done some tromping about within. So.
Yeah. Oh, fantastic. I mean, I'm glad you mentioned that, because the Hockomock Swamp is obviously something I'm aware of, because I've seen that brilliant documentary that's on Prime about the Bridgewater Triangle, and that's another area where you have got, as you refer to there, that seems to have everything going on in that area. The Bridgewater Triangle is one of those, as we label them, areas of high strangeness, because it seems to have everything kicking off up there.
Oh yeah, and that's one where, you know, you couldn't mention notorious swamps yes. in the U.S. without having Hockomock, because, you know, not only has the swamp got quite a few numbers of phenomena going on just there, and I'm talking cryptids, UFOs, ghosts, all kinds of stuff just in that, and if you branch, you know, zoom out to the whole Bridgewater Triangle zone. The whole area is just something weird going on up there, you know, to have this much strangeness. So, yeah, that's certainly one that I, you know, needed to cover and had to cover, and was cool because it kind of gave me something to lead off that wasn't just in the South. You know, there are swamps everywhere, and that's one, if not one of the most notable of them all.
Yeah, certainly yes. is. Like I say, it's one that's well known, primarily because I think the one creature that tends to stick out that's alleged to knock about up there is obviously the Pugwudgie, which sounds a very strange creature.
Yeah, this sort of, you know, short, creepy, I don't know how to even describe it. It's just like a really spooky hobbit type thing, I guess. You know. That's our version of the Hobbit. I don't know, but it's cool too, because it's, you get to examine a variety of creatures and legends and tales all within the one area. And the Pukwudgie is one that extends back to Native American tales about this sort of a trickster type creature that lived in the woods. And then you fast forward to modern times and you've got modern reports of people seeing something that fits within that description. And yeah, definitely one that is fun to write about, because it gives me an opportunity to cover something that otherwise there's not enough to it to make a book or anything. So it's got to be covered within the context of either the swamp or the Bridgewater Triangle or what have you. So I was excited to be able to write about Pukwudgies.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think looking at some of the footage I've seen up there, you're probably best off not visiting it, because they tend to have as on that documentary, someone is allegedly possessed by one and goes a bit, it all gets a bit frantic, to be honest. So, yeah, I think it's one of those places best viewed from a distance, Lyle.
Possibly so. People keep telling me, the warning me against this sort of thing, as I insist on delving into it, but you know, I always say, hey, if I if I was possessed and survived, it would make a better story anyway. So it's a win-win.
Absolutely. Yeah. Putting the art before everything else, my friend. So when's the book due out? Have you got a potential date lined up as yet?
I don't have a solid date. I'm probably looking at the earliest this summer. So hopefully, and that seems perfect for the swamp, a hot, humid time of year. So I think summer is when it will be released. But of course, people can will be updated by me on social media and what have you as I know the schedule.
Ah, fantastic. Well, I look forward to that, as I do with all your books. And I think that's one of the things that sets your books apart, Lyle, is the fact that you actually do take the time to go and visit these places, you know, as you refer to when you first went to Folk and Louisiana and Missouri to you know, get a feel of the area, which I think is what elevates your books, because, you know, you're basically taking us on a trip around the town, and you're taking us to the locations and speaking to people and just giving us a bit more meat on the bones of the actual story. And I think that always does your work an extra bit of credit that it, for me, I think it just gives us a bit more that perhaps we don't normally get in certain books.
Oh, well, thank you. I definitely try to go the extra mile. And I mean, I always kind of, when I started writing books, I always tried to write something that I would want to read, you know, and after reading quite a number of, you know, cryptozoology and other type similar books, you know, I thought, you know, it's one thing to just sort of delve out the sightings, but it's another thing to sort of analyze the area and talk about the people and to go into these woods. And so I always thought that, and it's obviously fun for me if I can possibly afford to do all those things somehow within the research, I jump at the chance. So I think that's been an exciting part about writing these things, is it gets me out, gets me have a purpose to go somewhere. And I have a purpose when I'm risking my life in the swamp for my readers.
Yes, you're probably very well aware how to fight off an alligator with a paddle, Lyle, I would suggest.
Well, let's hope so. I've been a few times that I've almost came up on one where it could have been dangerous. So thus far I've survived, but yeah, I'm always learning to be more careful and what to look for as I'm out there, I'm sure.
Absolutely. I'm sure you've probably learned far more about snakes than you ever thought you'd know.
which are the, to me, those are the most, you know, I'd almost rather see a Bigfoot or a ghost than some of the pits of water moccasin cottonmouths that I've seen, or ones hanging off trees glaring at me. I'm like, dude, I'd rather see a puck wedgie than that thing.
Absolutely. I've seen notable pieces of footage. I think one particular clip was a chap who's fishing off a little pier, and he's got this wonderful fish, and then all of a sudden this cottonmouth just turns up, so he ends up reeling them both in. I was like, right, throw that back. Not going anywhere near that.
Yeah, no, that's not a surprise I want to get at the end of the reel there. Oof.
Yeah, big time. So, obviously, already this year, I've noticed your conference and festival itinerary is already filling up. So, have you found that this has continued to build as well, Lyle, that you now seem to be doing more and more of these? Because I think you've already – are you already booked for 10 this year, I think you know?
There's even more than – yeah, there's even more than that, just as I sort of add them or confirm them. So, yeah, at least 10. And they just continue to grow. There just seems to be, you know, from the tried and true Bigfoot festivals that, you know, occur each year, they get bigger. And then there's others popping up that instantly draw a crowd to, you know, even just libraries and wherever I can go, like, for example, in Missouri, booking, you know, speaking presentations at libraries because people want to learn about local culture. And it's just there's almost more event invitations that I get than I can even accept, because there's only so many weekends in a month, and the travel and logistics of it gets complicated. So, but those are great things, and it puts me out there meeting people in person, you know, fans of the books, and oftentimes getting a way to go to an area, making it economically feasible, because every time I do, someone will come in and say, you know, I had this encounter, or did you know my grandfather saw Momo, or whatever, and I'm constantly learning more. So it's much better than, you know, just simply sitting at home doing research. It's getting me out there and meeting people.
Yeah. I mean, to be fair, I think it's one of those things that, you know, as a musician, you're used to traveling, but I think it's wonderful that you've now been able to sort of add to that this love of the weird, Lyle, that's probably got you, as you say, you make that economic decision, that's probably got you to places and met people and got reports that you could never probably have imagined 5-10 years ago that you would even be in this position.
Oh, certainly. Yeah, I would have, you know, when I first started writing The Beast of Boggy Creek, I never even thought that there was such a thing where people would invite me places around the U.S. and want to hear the stories. And certainly touring in the band always had me in every big city, you know, primarily. And so I got to see the world that way, and, you know, including, you know, London and other places. But it was always the big cities. With this, I tend to find myself more in out of the way places or rural areas, like, you know, Louisiana, Missouri, or Falk, Arkansas, or Point Pleasant, West Virginia. So now I'm getting a tour of small towns and the places where legends have come from. So this is a whole nother chapter to my world exploration.
Ah, fantastic. And touching on the band, so I think it was 3 years since the last album, was it Ghosts of the Southern Sun? Are you planning on taking Ghoul Town back out, or I think you might, are you planning to do some more recording?
Yeah, in fact, 3 years. Yeah, I've been
sorry.
Slowly. That's a good reminder of get the flame under it. But yeah, I've actually written another album, and we're in the process of learning those songs so we can record hopefully in March. So it's one of those things I have to kind of juggle, but there's a lot of fans of the band, and it's something I like to do. If writing books and cryptid stuff is my day job, then this is my night job, and I love both. So I try to balance that. So yeah, we should have a new album out. Who knows? You know, maybe later this year, about as basically as fast as I can work on things. But, I'm sure the fans will be glad that we're doing something on that, the musical front as well.
Brilliant. Well, let's hope it brings you back to the UK as well, because I think you played London on the last tour, did you?
Yeah. We came over there to play the Ramblin' Man Festival, which is the big, you know, festival there. And then we played London at the same time. So usually that's kind of how it operates now. It's hard to dedicate enough time to just do a, you know, go everywhere type tour. So if we can get on with a big festival or play, you know, a concentrated area in a short period of time, that's kind of how we do it. And hopefully some other European stuff will come up. We get invitations, but, you know, a lot of it just depends on my availability, obviously.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, all power to you, sir, because I think most people would love to be able to say that, you know, their love of rock and roll and monsters is taking them around the world, which yours certainly is, and all power to you.
Right. Yeah. Who could have ever thought this when I was a kid? I'm going to be a monster hunting musician. You know, nobody offered me that career path when I was at, you know, career day or whatever. Whatever, scientist, doctor. I'm like, ah.
Yeah.
So somehow I've managed to eke that into something that sustains me well enough. So I'm fortunate and thankful for that.
Absolutely. You still contributing to Rue Morgue? You still working for those guys?
Well, actually, last year I decided to bow out of that. It is coming to the point where it was so much stuff and I was pulled in so many directions. I thought, you know, I've just, as much as I love everything, I've got to let go of some of it. And that was sort of an obligation that didn't, you know, I wasn't, I wasn't the feature thing in the mag or anything. And I thought, you know, they can possibly get by without me. I don't know how, but But yeah, I just had to bow out, which I regret, but I just couldn't do everything. So, I'm currently still a subscriber and a reader, but just not a contributor.
Well, I think, with the greatest respect, Lyle, there's only so many plates so many people can keep spinning. And I think that, it's credit to you. You probably realized that you couldn't give it the time it deserved, and therefore it's better to quit while you're ahead than have people question your commitment, I suggest.
Yeah, exactly. Just, it makes me feel less scattered in what I've got to do, and concentrate on doing the best when I'm doing something, a book or music. I need to put as much as I can into that to do the best work I can. And if I'm pulled in too many places, that just becomes hard.
Absolutely. So, listen, thank you so much for your time today, as always. It's always a pleasure. And thank you for coming back. So, firstly, where can everybody keep up to date with your work and follow you and find out where you'd be appearing this year?
Well, the best place would be to hit my website, Lyle Blackburn, LYLE Blackburn.com. And at LyleBlackburn.com, you can find links to the band, Ghoultown.com, or the aforementioned Fout Monster website, where you can kind of follow the other projects. But my books are available on the store, which is on my website, if you would like autographed copies, or you can get them on Amazon as well. And they are on the Amazon UK site for my UK followers. And be sure to pick those up and to drop me a line if you've seen something weird or if you found my book to be interesting. And I appreciate all the feedback. And obviously I've got a Facebook page and Instagram page and all those links you can get at LyleBlackburn.com as well.
Well, fantastic. And like I said, thank you once again for coming back. Clearly it didn't terrify you too much a year ago, Lyle. And I will hopefully get a hold of the copy of the next book when it comes out and have a look at that, and hopefully we'll get a chance to speak to you again sometime.
Absolutely. I appreciate it. You're quite knowledgeable and I enjoy being on the show very much. So, I look forward to that in the future.
Well, I'll take that as a massive. That'll be my head swelled for the rest of the day, Lyle. So thank you very much, sir.
You're quite welcome.
Well, listen, take care. Thank you again, and all the very best.
Thank you very much.